Chris Mackey is the pseudonym for a highly trained army interrogator sent to Afghanistan right after the attacks on September 11th. When he left 3 months later, Chris Mackey had supervised military interrogations at Bagram Airfield outside Kabul. Greg Miller is a national security correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, the only journalist at the time granted access to those interrogators. Together, they've written an account of their experiences called The Interrogators. It began for Chris Mackey in the Taliban stronghold of Kandahar with a nightmarish scene that opens the book.
As always, it happened at night. A cargo plane touched down in the darkness, its lights doused to avoid attack. Its rear ramp lowered, revealing a ragged train of enemy fighters in bare feet and rags, emerging like aliens in the red-hued light of the cargo hold. Their heads were covered in burlap sacks, but their breath was still visible in the frigid air. They were bound together in long chains, and as they were spirited down the ramp, if one were to stumble, he would pull the others down with him.
How did you feel when you saw this scene?
Well, in the beginning, I was kind of shocked by it. I had always pictured prisoners coming to us in the traditional way that we had trained, you know, big convoys of trucks, people being taken out of the back of the truck, lined up in formation. The first time I saw it, it took me a little while to get registered and get reset that this is how this war is going to be fought. But when we left, I never even remarked about it anymore. It was just a common scene.
Paint a picture for us of the situation you were in, and how that might have differed from what you might have expected from your training.
Well, the interrogation training that I went through and most of the interrogators that accompanied me to Afghanistan went through was focused on opposing the Warsaw Pact and getting a conscript from the Eastern Bloc. So when we did encounter the first Taliban or Al-Qaeda prisoners, we were surprised by the fact that they bear no resemblance whatsoever to the prisoners that we had trained to break and trained to question. They were motivated by something spiritual and trying to overcome that kind of conviction with incentive of a cigarette or incentive of living in Dearborn, Michigan when the war is over was an extremely difficult thing to do and almost never worked.
If I could add something to what Chris just said, he was among the first interrogators who arrived in Afghanistan not that long after the September 11 attacks. And he and his unit were largely left to sort out on their own the rules of interrogation.
The prisoners you first encountered in Afghanistan 3 years ago, did they believe that the Americans would not physically torture them or kill them? Or had they heard that, in fact, that's exactly what was going to happen to them?
We saw both instances while we were there. In some cases, prisoners were under the impression that nothing would ever happen to them while they were in custody, and in fact that was reinforced when some soldiers in the field recovered an Al-Qaeda resistance to interrogation manual and brought it back, and we discovered that that's what they had been trained to believe in their Al-Qaeda training camps. But we also had prisoners who were certain that they would fall into American hands and we would follow the Soviet model and that they would be tortured until they talked.
We have heard stories of prisoners being told they would be sent to another country where torture was practiced. Did you ever do that?
We certainly used a lot of techniques to try to increase anxiety in a prisoner because we knew that that was another effective way to get them to cooperate. But we had to be very careful because the Geneva Conventions expressly forbid coercion when people are not cooperating in the provision of intelligence information. So what we used to do was, we used to say, if you don't cooperate, we're going to send you back to Algeria, or we're going to send you back to Tunisia, where these were wanted men. And in general, we allowed them to imagine what the consequences of that would be themselves.
And did you ever follow through?
Not that I know of, and we certainly had no capacity to make such a transfer.
Greg Miller.
There's a scene in the book where this is described, a chapter that's devoted to one of the more elaborate ruses that they employed on the prison floor. One of the interrogators, who was of Arabic background and who could pass himself as a convincing Gulf State Arab. And they staged an event, basically, on the prison floor where they were bringing prisoners out of the cage one at a time and putting tape across their chests, with some being marked destination as Gulf Arab State. We've been asked by the Army not to identify it specifically, I think. But the prisoners would then be just panic-stricken that they were being identified for transport back to this state, where they knew, or they at least would suspect, they would be encountering much harsher treatment than they had gotten at Bagram. And a number of prisoners come to the edges of the cages. They know they're leaving on this plane tomorrow. Come to the edges of the cages, claiming to have stomach ailments or other ailments and asking to be let out of the cages to go to the infirmary. Well, it's all an excuse so they can get out and try to plead their case one last time and share last pieces of information in a last-ditch effort to avoid this fate, which in reality was a plane that was headed for Guantanamo Bay.
There are stories about prisoners being tortured and dying in interrogation situations in Afghanistan. I wonder if in those 3 months after September 11th that you were there, if you saw anything like this or saw the beginnings of any of the level of abuse in interrogations.
Well, to start off with, if we had seen anything that resembled those accusations that have been leveled, then we would have immediately reported it, and we certainly wouldn't have been a party to it. And I wish that I could tell you that in every single person that was motivated exclusively by the highest ethics, and perhaps it was that. But if that wasn't enough, it was certainly enough that every single person labored under the sure knowledge that if we had done anything like that, everything they told us in the schoolhouse about the repercussions for failure to obey the Geneva Conventions would materialize. Did I see the development, or at least the germ seed of the behavior that might have eventually turned into something like what we've recently heard about? The answer to that is no, but I can say that interrogation is a debilitating job, and as you're there for a very long time, you begin to entertain ideas that would not necessarily have been countenanced on the onset.
When you, the interrogator, have broken a subject, which, you'll pardon me, but it has a sinister aspect.
The word is a little evocative, yes.
Yeah. What exactly is that?
Breaking a prisoner is the subject of intense amount of training, and specifically, it's the point in time where the prisoner is willing to share with you information of intelligence value. And what we really discovered was that very, very infrequently does someone just throw in the towel and say, I'm done, I'm ready to give up. In fact, what typically happens is that they'll share with you some tiny, tiny tidbit of information. Of course, we were always in search of the great break, and interrogators were often heard to tell their senior interrogator, I'm on the verge of a classic schoolhouse break. But I think it only happened once or twice in the entire time that we were in Afghanistan.
Army interrogator Chris Mackey and journalist Greg Miller are the authors of The Interrogators, Inside the Secret War Against Al-Qaeda.